Our thanks to Metacress for sponsoring the July episode of Practical Significance. Their product, Epicos AI, offers a comprehensive AI-driven ecosystem, redefining research from study design to publication. The integrated modules ensure methodological rigor, providing validated tools for protocol development, biostatistical analysis, and reporting. Exclusively for ASA members, Epicos AI offers a one-week full-access trial. Simply create an account at epicosai.com and enter code Houston in the Have a Promo Code section of your personal dashboard. Empower your entire research journey and build confidence in your science with Epicos AI. Thanks again to Metacrest for supporting the Practical Significance podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Practical Significance, a podcast to inspire listeners with compelling stories from statistics and data science and to propel data-driven careers forward. Here are your hosts, the ASA's Associate Executive Director, Donna Lalonde, and Executive Director, Ron Wasserstein.
Well, welcome everyone to the July episode of Practical Significance. I'm really delighted to be able to have a conversation with two wonderful colleagues from Langer Research who have served the ASA community so well in a number of ways. But today we're going to talk about the work salary survey and maybe some other things as well. So before we dig into the results, I'm going to ask Christine and Gary to tell us a little bit about your day job. So Christine, I'll start with you.
Thanks for having us. My name is Christine Feiler. I have a PhD in communication with a minor in government and public policy. Of course, I thought I was going to be a professor, but over the years in my grad program, I found myself focusing more and more on research. And so I've been really happy to have landed at a boutique custom research shop where I get to participate in every step of the research process. From the very beginning, when we're just starting to figure out what our design might be, all the way through to the end, when we're thinking through the best way to communicate results and convey those in whatever format is most appropriate.
And Christine, I'm just going to tell our listeners that you and I always have to start, though, the conversation with what races you might be running
this
and
what
races I'm not running these days. But so it's great to have you. And Gary, what drew you to this kind of work?
Well, first, I want to point out that Christine is our most senior research analyst at our company. She's been with us for getting on near 10 years now, and she's just a wonderful colleague and employee to have with us. So my own background is kind of interesting. I'm rather than a researcher, although I do some of that, I'm a newsman by training and temperament. I started as a reporter at the Associated Press, you know, covering train wrecks, plane crashes, and three alarm fires. But AP had me take over a little news poll they had going because all the other reporters were too math phobic to go anywhere near it. And I parlayed that into a 20-year career at ABC News, mostly as director of polling, where again, I was sort of covering the beat of public opinion for our news audience. Then a while ago, 16 years ago, I took the opportunity to start our company, Langer Research Associates. We focus on purposeful social science research that serves the public good, which, if you think about it, is really not unlike the same motivations that inform my previous career in data-focused journalism. But we do a variety of super interesting research projects on public policy, public attitudes, chiefly for foundations and nonprofits with a busy national and also international practice.
That's great, Gary. And I think that you have a strong connection to a former ASA president, because I kind of have in this mind that when Rob Santos was recognized by APOR, you actually did the interview. So small world.
Rob's a great guy and a good friend, too. Yep.
So let's jump right in and ask you both what surprised you most about the results, and whoever would like to go first.
I'll pick that up. Christine could follow. You know, one thing I'll say, a little almost pushback on that question, is that going into any project, we have research questions, sometimes hypotheses, but I try not to have expectations per se, because we don't want to filter our analysis through our own predispositions. We want to hear from our respondents in their own context, from where they're coming from. So no expectations, no surprises. That said, I think there's some really compelling results. If not surprising, then certainly very interesting, particularly to me when we talked about and asked about the impacts of the federal budget cuts over the last recent period. 90% saw these cuts as a negative. 90% of ASA members who participated in our survey, rising to nearly unanimously 96% of federal employees. 80% of ASA members said these budget cuts had impacted their employer negatively, and more than half, 55%, said they were personally negatively impacted by the federal cuts, rising to 75% of federal employees themselves. As a result of these perceived negative impacts, we saw really just dramatic shifts, particularly among federal employees, in declines in things like job satisfaction, job security, and overall morale. Just in one example, when we asked in 2020, the last time we did this survey, federal employees, they were very satisfied with their job security. 84% were. In this survey, it's 13%. So really dramatic shifts there.
That's a spectacular shift. Actually, I've never heard of such a thing. It's amazing. So, Christine, did you have any additional comments?
I would just add, stepping away from the results for a second, I wasn't so much surprised because this is not the first time we've done a survey with the ASA membership, but I was very appreciative that so many members took time out of their busy days to sit down and go through the survey.
Great segue into our next question, Christine, and that is we had a lot of conversations about the trade-offs, and we didn't want to make it too long. We didn't want to make it too short. We wanted to make sure that we asked all of the most compelling questions. Can you talk a little bit about, from your perspective, what was the hardest call in terms of putting this work salary survey together?
Yeah, that length that you mentioned, I think that was the hardest thing for me, is just thinking through the different topics of interest and what content we wanted to focus on. There are so many different things that would be really interesting and give us compelling results, but at the same time, we don't want to put together an hour-long questionnaire and expect people to sit through it and take that and still give us good data. So I'd say that that was the hardest call that we made together, was figuring out what exactly do we want to ask about in the questionnaire.
Yeah, I would add that in earlier iterations, this originally started, I think, at ASA before our participation as a salary survey, really focused on compensation issues, which is of great value, I think, for members to know and hear about. At the same time, we envisioned it as a broader focus, not only on salary, but on workplace conditions. And we went into some of that in the original survey we did with the ASA 6 years ago. But we went back at it. And in this case, I thought, among other workplace experience and satisfaction issues, that measuring attitudes toward the changes in the federal government and the cuts that were coming down were really important this time around. We'll go back to field, hopefully, again in the future. And again, look at what's going on and see what's timely and important to cover above and beyond the important compensation issues that we also look at here.
So as you looked at those compensation issues across the spectra, what stood out?
To me is, I think honestly, maybe it was just personally edifying, but compensation increases with professional experience as well as a higher degree. So when we look at median total employment income for full-time employees, that's lower for those with 5 or fewer years of experience across all sectors, but then that raises or increases with each additional set of tenure that we looked at. So then that goes all the way up to about $210,000 for those with 26 or more years of experience. And then the same thing, median total employment income is higher for those with PhDs. It's $175,000 than for those whose highest degree is a master's, $145,000. I think that's in line with maybe what we might expect, but at the same time, I do think that that is encouraging, that to see that professional experience and also going through a doctoral program are things that are rewarded.
Yeah, we also saw interesting divisions by sector in which the highest reported pay was among individuals working in business or industry, followed pretty closely by either federal government or nonprofit employees, and followed more distantly by those in academia. But again, with, as Christine points out, tenure and education level is a strong factor. It was also interesting to me that nearly half, well, 44% of employed members who participated in the survey reported additional pay from their employer besides their base pay, chiefly in the form of bonuses. And the additional pay was particularly prevalent among those working for for-profit businesses, followed by federal workers, and then academia, and lowest for those working in nonprofits. So if you're looking for a bonus, maybe nonprofit might not be your first choice.
I don't think too many of us went into the nonprofit sector thinking that we were going to get rich doing it. But as you were talking about these results, one of the things that occurred to me, not something that necessarily shows up in the data, but our members are continual learners. It's just the nature of our field. They have to be doing professional development all the time. And that works its way out ultimately into compensation, although the mapping for that isn't necessarily direct.
Yeah, I think looking at additional training, I think lifelong learning, if you will, would be a really interesting element to probe further in out year studies. We looked at existing educational attainment, and it is a strong factor, but looking at ongoing refresher courses and the rest and certifications, I think could be super interesting.
I'll point out, though, we did ask satisfaction with different factors in your primary job. So maybe something for managers to keep in mind is that the learning and development opportunities is one of the items that people are least likely to be very satisfied with at their current job. So room for improvement there if you're in a position to provide additional opportunities for people at your company to do that professional development.
And I just can't resist taking the opportunity to say, and does the ASA have some fantastic professional development opportunities? So thank you for teeing that up for me, Christine. So we maybe have touched on this a little bit about sort of the tension between getting rich, nuanced data and keeping the survey short enough so people finish it. And I think that that came out for me, not only in the overall length, but even in your advice on how to construct the questions so that the questions weren't a book long, right? And so I just wonder if you all would talk a little bit about in this project, but maybe in other projects, how you sort of navigate that tension.
Yeah, this is a key element of our work, Donna, because questionnaire design is far too often the forgotten stepchild of the research enterprise, and it is really important. We haven't seen a ton of research on survey length, but what's there indicates pretty clearly that what matters is not length per se, but cognitive length. So long batteries, lots of repetition, overly complex questions create cognitive burden, which impacts data quality, especially as the cognitive length increases. So what's important is to have an instrument that's clear, engaging, and devised to minimize cognitive burden. Keep it interesting, focused, straightforward. If you get that, then length isn't so much of an issue. And with a good instrument, once people start, by and large, they finish. So among people who took our survey, went through the first question, 96% stayed with us to the end.
So I feel like I can really relate to the cognitive burden issue. The beasts that are carrying my cognitive burden these days are not holding their end up, I'm telling you. But speaking of burdens, one of the big burdens that anyone who's in your line of work faces is non-response. So recognizing that and recognizing that our listeners are pretty sophisticated in this area, what are the caveats that you would want people to be especially aware of as they look through the results of this survey?
Well, I can jump in on that. A couple of things. We want the best cooperation, the highest response we can get, but non-response isn't the best standard for survey quality, because what matters is whether the non-response is random or systematic, right? Systematic non-response is potentially biasing if it's systematic in terms of anything related to the variables we're studying. If it's random non-response, then it still fits neatly into the principles of inferential statistics, so we're okay. So we'd like the best response we can get, but what we really care about is we have a representative sample, and we compare our results to the data available in the ASA files in terms of demographics of the audience. Now, it's not a perfect census. There's a lot of missing data in the ASA records. So we didn't feel comfortable going ahead and waiting, but they really lined up pretty nicely. And there's a table given in our report that shows our unweighted demographic data among survey participants and compared with what we can see in the ASA roster for the same individuals. And I think it really is pretty reassuring, not for the same individuals, for the full population, sorry. We also approach it with an abundance of caution. And in our report itself, we say that because it's not a sample survey, it doesn't have a high response rate as a census, we went to the full membership, then we prefer, and ASA prefers to present results as indicative, but not as reliably representative of the full population within a calculable margin of sampling error. So I think we're being very cautious and responsible, but I also think it's strong and compelling data and certainly worth a look.
So following up on that, as we release this podcast, we'll also make your excellent reports available on the website. So to our listeners, obviously, we want them to read the whole report, but is there a section or a part or one thing that you would tell them to go to first and read? And maybe why does that stand out for you?
To me, this is really like a pick your poison. So we have an appendix where we give the top line results. And if you want to just scroll through that quickly and get a sense of what questions were asked, you can do that. We also have salary tables. So if you want to look at median compensation for different groups, all of that is laid out too. Or you can just start from the top and read through. I don't think that either report is prohibitively long. And that could be a nice way to go through and read the narrative to sort of put everything in your mind as you go through.
Yeah, I would just add to that, that we really had two topics that we focused on this time around. We had a study focused on employment, who's working where among the ASA membership, and salary and compensation levels. And then a separate section in which we looked at attitudes on federal cuts and also workplace conditions. And I think they were different enough that we thought it was a good idea to break it out into two separate reports, as readers will see. So there's one report on where folks are working and what they're being compensated with, and a separate report on workplace conditions and attitudes and views of the recent federal cutback. So whichever of those is of greater interest, although personally I think they're both worth a read, is where you might go first.
Indeed, we won't be choosing our poison. We'll be trying to decide which place at the banquet table we want to start feasting at first. So I think it's impossible, perhaps illegal, to have any conversation now without talking about AI somehow or another. There's lots of hype. If we can cut past that to ask you just what ways so far have you seen that AI is changing your work? And what do you see coming in terms of how it might be changing your work? And no, I'm not asking you to predict the entire future of AI, just what you see may be happening in your line of work.
This is a tough one for me in that it hasn't really changed the way I work yet. I have been trying, and so far it only slows me down. You know, even when I get the prompts really how I think that they should be, it's just not comparison for having spent years and years and years developing questions and editing questionnaires and doing data analysis and writing that up. I think it's very useful to me in terms of writing syntax, especially if it's a function or something that I haven't done in a while. And I don't remember what the code is, right? Like I know it, but I don't remember it. I think AI is really quick to give me that. But I think more complicated in terms of synthesizing information and putting that together, it's not doing it for me yet. And I think in part that's because we do put such importance on the exact words that we're using in our questions and on our questionnaires. In terms of shift I'm bracing for, I would say just the expectation and how long it takes to put together good work. I am concerned that with generative AI becoming more and more popular, that there will be expectations that things can be turned around more quickly than I think maybe they should be for good, responsible research.
Yeah, we're kind of like custom tailors in our shop. We spend a lot of personal time and attention and many years of expertise into the work we do. And so far, we're working up a policy. Other than checking coding, checking syntax, we're not seeing a lot of opportunities there in the way we do our work. Nearly everyone on our team attended the recent conference at APOR, and there were a lot of presentations on AI, and a lot of them were fairly problematic. It left me thinking of AI pretty much as a really bad intern, someone who requires lots and lots of time and attention, and at the end of the day doesn't produce a particularly good product. So we're keeping our eyes open. I have to tell you, though, at the same time, on the business side, I received some really pretty disheartening pitches at this conference from folks who were selling AI agents and tools. One person had actually scraped together many, many analyses, poll analyses I've written over the years to show me how his agent could write as well as I could. And what it turned out was nonsense. So that didn't work for me. Then the next pitch was that it's a way to eliminate low-level employees. And I find that just so objectionable, even the concept of a low-level employee. Everyone I work with has really great value and contributes meaningfully to the work of our group. And to think of anyone as low-level is exactly the way we don't do business. The next thing is, well, it'll eliminate rote tasks. So you don't have to run tabs. AI will do it for you. You don't have to build tables. AI will do it for you. You don't have to build charts. AI will do it for you. But in fact, running tabs and building tables and producing charts is the very way that we lay the foundations of our analytical work by fully involving ourselves in the data and going through it line by line to learn it and to learn what our research is telling us so we can then transmit it to our audiences. So to think a machine's going to do that for you is really not at all aligned with the way that we approach our task.
You know, Gary and Christine, we sort of jumped right into the nuts and bolts of the survey and the analysis. So I wonder, before I ask you a final question, I might just step back and say, is there anything about the process? Like, Christine, I know you spent a lot of time with our IRB submission, for example, to make sure that we were practicing best practices. And so is there anything about the process that hasn't come up in the questions that we've asked that you would like to share?
Well, I jump in on that only to say that, look, the key to any data collection process is the participation of your target population. And we got good co-op compared to surveys of this type done among other groups, but it's down from what it was 6 years ago. And I think the results are really interesting, in many ways compelling, highly valuable to the membership. And I think the key takeaway for me is to really try to encourage members, when this comes around again, to give serious consideration to participating. It's a pretty brief, straightforward survey, and the results are super important in informing the membership about each other's prospect and conditions, working conditions and compensation, and really important things that it can be super helpful to learn about. The more participation we get, the better data we get. And I'd really like to encourage that piece.
That's great. Thanks so much. Well, we have a few traditions on Practical Significance, and one of the traditions is that we always like to end by adding to our TBR watching list, our reading list, our listening list. So, Christine, I know from past experience that you are filled with wonderful suggestions, at least on the TBR side. So tell us what you're reading, listening to, watching, all of the above.
Thanks for the compliment, Donna. I just started a book called Returns and Exchanges by Kayla Ray Whitaker. I love a long family saga, and I think this book is going to give me that. And then I'm also really excited this summer, we are getting the third installment in Colson Whitehead's Harlem trilogy. So I plan to go back to the start and reread Harlem Shuffle in advance of that third book coming out, which I'm really excited for. I think reading all three of them together is just going to be a really rewarding experience. In terms of TV, I am a huge Yankees fan. So if my TV is on, there's usually a baseball game on. Though, of course, right now, too, we've got the Knicks in the finals. Go Knicks. And listening, as Donna mentioned, I run. So I listen to a lot of mashups while I run miles and miles.
That's great. And I guess for our listeners, I should let them know that you are on the East Coast. And so that Yankees and Knicks thing is local, right? Those are your
yes,
local teams.
I'm local. That's right.
Gary, what about you?
Well, a few things here. This is kind of horrifying, but most of my recent reading has been research papers on AI infiltration into online panels. It's actually really interesting. There's a lot of important work that's come out on that just in the past year. The other thing I read a lot is RFPs as we assess new project opportunities, too. My playlist in between Dad Rock and the New York Philharmonic. We went and saw Prokofiev a couple of weeks ago. It was just a wonderful performance. On TV, we found a really fun little, just a 2 or 3 season Danish political drama called Borgen, B-O-R-G-E-N. That was wonderfully acted and wonderfully scripted and unusual. That might be a good tip. But mainly these days, my main home is 50 miles north of New York City. And we spend most of our time running our dog. And this time of year, growing tomatoes and cucumbers. They're just starting to come out.
Well, I heartily endorse the spending time with the dog thing. So that that works for me. Where was Borden? Where can we watch it?
Yeah, I think it's on Amazon Prime. It's Borgen, B-O-R-G-E-N, which is the name of the building that houses the federal government in Denmark.
Okay.
And it's a Danish series. You got to watch it with the subtitles on, but it's a great yarn.
Cool. Great. Wonderful. Well, thank you both so much for talking with us about the work salary survey. And thank you again for the excellent work that you did on behalf of the ASA in getting us to a work salary survey report. We have another tradition on practical significance, and that is Ron's top 10. So I will turn it over to my colleague, Ron, for the top 10.
Thank you, Donna. Well, the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence is here. The impending holiday got me to thinking, never a good idea, about crucial moments in world history that could have been different if there had been statisticians around back then. So, always eager to promote our profession, the Practical Significance Podcast presents the top 10 historical events that statisticians could have influenced had there been any. Number 10, back in 44 BCE, statisticians could have warned Julius Caesar about the spike in his hazard function around the Ides of March. Number 9, the year 1066. Arguably, the Anglo-Saxons might have fended off the French with the strategic use of the Metropolis Hastings algorithm. Number 8, 1492. Statisticians could have warned Columbus that the confidence interval on his longitude estimates was plus or minus one continent. Number 7, the year 776 BCE. At the first Olympic Games, statisticians would have provided crucial advice on the use of control charts in chariot construction. Number 6, 210 BCE. A statistician could have mentioned to the first emperor of the Qin dynasty that the expected value of drinking mercury as an immortality potion was not, in fact, immortality. Number 5, 1633. Perhaps the church would have absolved Galileo if he could have shown them that the AIC indicated the heliocentric model was a better fit. Number 4, 1215. Any statistician would have observed that the 63 clauses in the Magna Carta left King John with no degrees of freedom. Number 3, 1776. England might not have lost America as a colony if statisticians had taught King George III about conditional independence. Number 2, 1789. The French wouldn't have needed to storm the Bastille if Poisson had developed a system for the equitable distribution of wealth rather than just a distribution of probability. And the number one historical event that could have been influenced by statisticians, had there been any, is 1347. The Black Plague might not have been so bad if, never mind, no one would have listened to statisticians then either. Well, that's it for this episode of Practical Significance. We look forward to continuing the discussion next month.
Epicos AI is an AI-supported research integrity ecosystem developed by Metacres, redefining the journey from study design to publication. It assists researchers, statisticians, and journal editors in identifying methodological weaknesses and ensuring statistical rigor through validated AI tools. Exclusively for ASA members, Epicos AI now offers a one-week full access trial. Simply create an account at epicosai.com and enter code Houston in the Have a Promo Code section of your personal dashboard to experience the future of research integrity. Strengthen the transparency and validity of your science with Epicos AI today.
Your data has a story.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Practical Significance, the podcast of the American Statistical Association. A new episode will be coming your way next month from AmStat News, the ASA's monthly membership magazine.